All right, those are our source texts for the next set of lessons we're going to do. We're going to be looking at the founding fathers and the role that faith played in the American experience. Hebrews 12, 1 and 2, we are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses. And if you look at 12, 1 and 2, it's coming at the end of Hebrews chapter 11, which talks about the great champions of faith. They were thrown in logs, they were sawn asunder, they were pulled apart by horses. And this is the cloud of witnesses that is watching what we are doing. And part of that cloud of witnesses are those that created the United States. And so as we look at the faith of the founding fathers, keep in mind that the framers of this country passed it on to us with the expectation that we would follow in their footsteps. And as you are more than well aware, this nation has wandered away from the steps and pathway that they have created. So we're going to look at the founding fathers, what their religious ideas were, and how those religious ideas influenced their political philosophy and then led to the creation of America in the Continental period and then shortly thereafter. So our focus is basically from the early colonial period up to, well, on into the 20th century, just because that gets us into the Second Great Awakening. And this is a good way to start off, because if you've got your bulletin, at least three of the songs that we are singing this morning are great revival hymns that were drafted in that period of the Second Great Awakening. Third Great Awakening. So it kind of ties into what we're doing today. The booklet that I've given out is an outline of what we're going to be doing. And if you turn on the back of the booklet, I started with this. This is the famous picture of George Washington praying at Valley Forge. They wintered at Valley Forge, which was not a great place to stick a bunch of troops. It was cold, it was snowy, it was icy. They had trouble getting supplies in. But that's not why Washington was praying. People forget that the reason they were encamped at Valley Forge was because Washington and his troops had suffered a serious defeat at the hands of the British, and they were trapped at the Delaware River, and they needed to escape. And so Washington, through the night fell, the British troops stopped, because that's what you did at night, and Washington saw, as the night was falling, hundreds of boats coming across and rescuing his troops and taking them across the river. So he sent out word, and every fisherman in the area came in and picked up his troops and took them across the river in the middle of the night. This had never been done before, and so when the dawn broke and the British were ready to go in, Washington's troops, which had been trapped and were just ready to be destroyed, weren't there. And it baffled the British troops long enough that Washington was able to retreat far enough and then spend the winter at Valley Forge. And in his diaries talking about that, Washington says that God gave him the vision of the way to save the American army, because if the troops had been trapped there in the coming morning, that would have been the end of the revolution right there. And so Washington, praying for guidance on how to conduct the war, praying for the safety of his troops, and thanking God for the providence of giving him an idea of how to rescue his troops in a military tactic that had never been done before. And interestingly, the same tactic was repeated in World War II at Dunkirk, and the American officer who called the British ships and had them come over and rescue the British army from destruction by the Germans remembered that story and said, I wonder if we could do the same thing. Now, providence in World War II was that the British troops were trapped at Dunkirk. They were stuck. The German army was completely surrounding them. World War II was about to end there. Hitler decided he wanted the Air Force to get the credit for destroying the British army instead of all of his tanks. And the weather was bad, clouds came in, rain came in, and the German Luftwaffe was grounded for 3 days. Whereas the tanks could have just plowed everything and finished it there. But for 3 days, Hitler waited until the clouds broke so the Air Force could get in. By then, the majority of the army had been pulled across the English Channel. There are 12 incidences, by the way, in World War II where you see providence of God that way. All right, so get your booklets out. Turn to the first page. This is a list of the lessons we're going to be looking at. First things first, today we're going to talk a little bit about who the Founding Fathers were. By and large, we define the Founding Fathers as those who wrote the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. That's a fair definition, but not entirely accurate. So what we're going to be looking at over the second lesson is the colonial foundings. Founding of Virginia, founding of Georgia, founding of the New England colonies, founding of the Mid-Atlantic colonies, because each one of them has a unique history. They're founded for different reasons, and yet each one of them has a unique religious heritage. I'm going to give you kind of a heads up today as we talk about James Oglethorpe, the founder of the Georgia colony, and talk a little bit about the Georgia founding, just to kind of get us thinking about that. So next week we're going to talk about the colonial founders. We'll talk about colonies that were established specifically for religious reasons, colonies that were established largely for economic reasons, the colonies that were established for to defend this new set of colonies against, well, the French from the north, the Spanish from the south, and the Russians and the French from the west. People forget that foreign policy was important to the colonies right from day one. Fourth time, we'll talk about religion in the frontier. We'll talk about the Bibles that the colonists used. The original colonists weren't crazy about the King James Bible. You knew. The Bible that founded America was this one here. Annabelle calls it the Peanut Bible because when you open it up, it smells sort of like peanuts. This is the Geneva Bible, first published in 1599. I'll let you pass it around just so everybody can take a look at it. Ray, I don't know if it's Ray or Ray's son, publishes those. Jim, you know who's it? It's a combination, yeah. The Geneva Bible was basically the Protestant Reformation Bible. It was incredibly significant in terms of Bible history, had enormous impact, and this was the Bible that the Puritans and the Pilgrims and the Jamestown colonists and the Georgia colonists brought with them. And this was the Bible that most Americans used well into the 1800s because we didn't like the British monarchy, and so we weren't going to use the King James Bible. The Geneva Bible, well, the Geneva Bible was originally written in Swiss and then translated to English. Martin Luther was the one that authorized the translation of that text. They used slightly different source texts. In terms of translation, not a whole lot of difference, but there are differences in word usage and sentence structure. Doctrinal difference? Your primary difference is over baptism. The King James translators just brought the word baptism over from the Greek. The Geneva translators used it as immersion because that's what it means. Baptism means to dunk, to soak. And then there are some differences in the approach to translating these Psalms, but those are literary differences more than... They sound largely similar to the King James. Names are translated a little differently, again, because they're coming from Latin to Swiss to English. And then they tend to follow the Lutheran tradition on names and numbers. But other than that, for the most part, the texts are very similar. The difference was political more than anything else. The colonists were breaking from England. They didn't want to be associated with the Anglican Church. The King James was the Anglican Church Bible. And so we're using the Geneva Bible more for political reasons than theological reasons. Yeah. Yeah, Bible translations are incredibly political. The other difference is the Geneva doesn't quite have the poetic flow of the King James, but that was an intentional translational decision by the translators of the King James. They wanted a pulpit Bible that had the essential rhythm and cadence of Latin. But that was in English, And so there's a real emphasis on the poetic nature of the King James, whereas the Geneva is a little less so. It doesn't have, some of the verses don't have quite the same rhythm. John 3:16 doesn't have that same flow. So that's the Bible that our colonial ancestors used. Now, I don't know if that one has it or not, but the King James, the Geneva, the 1800 Pew Bible, all of them had the Apocrypha in them. The Apocrypha was part of Protestant Bibles really up until about the 1840s, and we'll talk about how that changed. The Baptists, by the way, were the first one. Yeah, 9 books, yeah. Yep. First and second Tobit, third Isaiah, several, Bell and Dragon, that kind of thing. Now, the Catholic Church never considered those books to be canonical, but they did consider them to have important historical and cultural information that was necessary. Luther agreed with that. Calvin went one way or the other. Zwingli, who was the great Swiss Enlightenment author, wanted to, his translations largely left them out or had them as a supplement. Canonical means that they are authoritative, that they have the stamp of scriptural authority, that they are the ones that were intended to be used for doctrine and training. No, that's why they've always been called the Apocrypha. Lay Catholics think that they have the same canonicity, but Catholic writers, Catholic scholars have never agreed that they had that canonicity. By 225 AD, the 66 books of the canon were established as the canonical books, and then these other books were just considered supplements. So we'll talk about the fight between the Geneva Bible and the King James Bible. So by the way, if you really want to have fun with people at Victory Baptist who are King James only, you can say that, well, if you really want to be good American churchgoers, you need to go with the Geneva Bible. But that's just me. And the second session we'll talk about the colonies. The third session we'll focus on Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, and Rhode Island. All religious colonies, all of which have, there was some interesting religious conflict in these colonies. Fourth lesson, we'll take a look at religion on the frontier, take a look at Bibles, take a look at the specific beliefs, and then talk about the denominational conflict in the colonies. Just because we're Puritans and Pilgrims and we're breaking away from England, we're trying to reform the church, doesn't mean we agree on how it's supposed to be done. Very quickly, the colonies were dominated by Congregationalists, Calvinists, Episcopals, Presbyterians, Methodists, Lutherans, and then out of all of that schlemiel of denominations grows the Baptist movement. And in chapter 5, or week 5, we'll be taking a look at how we specifically broke away from the traditions of the English church. And that was incredibly political. We'll touch on a couple court cases just to give you a heads up. Chapter 6, or week 6, we're talking about the American Revolution, we're talking about the Declaration of Independence. We'll talk about Thomas Jefferson's very complicated relationship with Christianity. I'll talk about John Adams. I will take a close look at John Hancock. Everybody knows he signed the Declaration of the Great Flourish, but very few people know about his religious heritage. And then we'll talk about Thomas Paine. Next week, we'll look at the Constitution. We'll take a look at the signatories of the Constitution. They are different people. There are only 6 people who signed the Declaration, also signed the Constitution. John Adams, who was instrumental in drafting the Declaration, did not sign the Constitution, even though he weighed in on it, because at the time he was in England. And then we'll talk about the philosophical and religious sources of the constitutional structure. We'll take a look at a political philosopher named David Hume, a very interesting man who gets practically no emphasis in political science classes. The 8th week, we'll take a look at the church in early American life, what role it played. Very different to the established coastal cities versus when you get farther out into the mountain areas like up here in West Virginia. The church played very different roles in those areas. Thank you. And so we'll talk about the role that the church played and how it influenced the evolution of the American states. We'll spend some time looking at the Second Great Awakening. The First Great Awakening, by the way, is week 5, where we take a look at breaking away from the religious traditions of Europe. The Second Great Awakening, 1800 to about 1840. The 10th week, we'll take a look at the Third Great Awakening and postmillennialism. The Third Great Awakening was really the religious movement that created the Baptist Church as we know it today. In many ways, the Baptist denomination was a reaction against the ideas that took over that Third Great Awakening. We will talk about some of the great publications, the fundamentals, This We Believe, and we'll talk about Baptist doctrine as it evolves in this period. And then we'll finish at week 11 with a discussion of what we should learn and what we should do, having studied all of this. So if you go through the booklet, I have the weekly lessons basically outlined here. Some of them, like lessons 1 and 2, are a little introductory paragraph, and then some of them are just in outline form. Others have a little introductory narrative because they're a little more complicated. For example, lesson 5, that's in the middle of the booklet, so if you just find the middle section and open it up. Lesson 5, breaking away from the English tradition. You notice that we're focusing largely on the First Great Awakening. Jonathan Edwards, George Whitefield. Names you're probably familiar with. You may be less familiar with Samuel Davies. Davies was a tent revivalist, the very first. Talk a little bit about the impact of the Great Awakening. The First Great Awakening was a massive religious movement that began with Jonathan Edwards, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. And we'll go over some of the key elements of that. That's a great sermon. I think every church at the anniversary of Edwards' birthday should read Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. It has some of the greatest phrases in all of Christendom. At least I think so. However, delivering it as Jonathan Edwards did would be a little difficult. But these religious ideas impacted the political institutions of the United States and then led to a number of schisms or splits in the church. And out of this grew what we now know as the modern Baptist denomination. Chapter 6, you can see we're talking different ideas. Chapter 6, we're going to look at the Declaration of Independence, and we're going to take a look at the theology of the Declaration of Independence. There's actually a good book I just ran across while I was working on this in Amazon that was published last year about the theological underpinnings of the Declaration. History professors were unhappy with it, but they didn't have anything to disprove it. So, Chapter 7, taking a look at the Constitution, and you notice getting a little introductory paragraph there. The early church will take us into my favorite Supreme Court case of all time, Dartmouth College v. Woodward. Great Awakening, Second Great Awakening, and the Third Great Awakening. If you're unfamiliar, most people are unfamiliar with the Third Great Awakening, but if you know Billy Sunday, you know a lot about the Third Great Awakening. I've got some nice video of Billy Sunday. Billy Sunday was the forerunner of Billy Graham. The difference being that Billy Sunday used to pound, he was a pulpit pounder, and he used to pound it to the point that bits and pieces would break off while he was preaching. And then as he got really wild, riled up, he'd kick the thing, and sometimes he'd actually just smash the pulpit down to bits. My grandfather saw him and was moved by his preaching and baffled by his methodology. Notice on week 10 we will talk about the fundamentals, which define the fundamentalist movement. And then, like as I said the last week, we will talk about what we as Christians ought to learn from all of this. So, first week then, today we want to talk, we've kind of overviewed the class. Give me 1 John 2:28. Now, little children, abide in him that when he appears we may have confidence and not be ashamed before him at his coming. This is a key text for us because it was a key text for the colonial authors. Many of the colonial governors cited this in talking about what they were trying to accomplish. William Penn had this at the as the introductory verse in his personal diary. It's a terribly important idea for the American experiment. Abide in him, that when he appears we may have confidence and not be ashamed before him at his coming. America was a unique political and social experiment. Clearly, once the New World was discovered by Columbus and Vasco da Gama and all of that, a great race began to see if we could settle the continent and take advantage of its economic and material wealth. Columbus believed that the New World was a great missionary endeavor. Christopher Columbus believed that, yeah, we should come here, we should help develop, but the natives were here, they needed Christ, and so our job then was to try to evangelize as much as we could, as well as, you know, develop colonies and expand essentially European civilization. Columbus was deeply concerned. Columbus made three trips to the New World. And it is true that all the time he believed he'd actually made it to India, even when evidence became clear that he had not. But he became very concerned because on his second trip back, he got delayed by, well, legal issues. He owed a lot of money, and they hadn't started bringing gold back yet. And so he was a guest of the Spanish government for a year, involuntary incarceration. And then when he made it back, he discovered that the lieutenant he had left in charge had started to enslave the native population. And Columbus thought this was the wrong thing to do and that it violated the conscience of good Christians. And so he wrote back to Ferdinand and Isabella and said, "We've got slavery going on here. Order it to stop." Well, Ferdinand and Isabella didn't care because his lieutenant had discovered gold and they were shipping gold back by the ton. And so Columbus took his case to the Pope. And the Pope issued a papal decree known as a papal bull saying that anybody who actively engaged in the slave trade would be excommunicated. And he ordered the Bishop of the Americas to excommunicate anybody involved in the slave trade. Well, that didn't go anywhere because the Bishop over the Americas was receiving kickbacks from the slave trade. And so he refused to excommunicate anybody, and that starts a whole line of religious tradition. And Columbus was very upset about this, and at the end of his third trip, when he came back from Spain, he actually tried to make a excommunication movement to some of the people over there. And as a consequence of this conflict with the Spanish crown, Columbus's reputation was ruined. He was never able to make the travel back. And he basically spent the rest of his life defending himself against legal and other claims. And Columbus was very disappointed in what he saw the Spanish development in the colonies as becoming, which was largely about gold and slaves, rather than about evangelism and a Christian experience. Columbus, when he got back from the third trip, wrote a number of letters to the Pope, to the Italians, to the French, to the Spanish crown, saying, "We need to get missionaries in here." The upshot of that was that they did eventually send a series of Franciscan monks over to Mexico and South America. Franciscans were great. They loved the Indian people. They took down their stories. They worked with them. They brought Christianity to them. The problem was they weren't getting their gold and they weren't getting their land. And so the Franciscans were pulled out and the Dominicans were sent in. And the Dominicans had an entirely different mindset. And that's where you start getting the Spanish missionaries, mission system as we know it. We have a mission with the Presidio, which is a military garrison, and the Dominicans became very effective at extracting gold and wealth and spreading Christianity, but not nearly in the way, not in the effective way that Franciscans were doing. And at that point, Latin American Christian history takes a very ugly turn. And Columbus spent the rest of his life basically railing against the abuse of the natives. And by the way, the Pope has never rescinded that encyclical. Every Pope that has followed has reauthorized the anti-slave position of the Church, even though it largely made no difference at all. So that's Columbus. And then when we get the colonial settlements, of course, the Virginia colonies, the Roanoke colony, which was a failure for a lot of reasons, but these Virginia settlements came largely to establish a colony, bring people over. They were largely for economic purposes, but they also had a strong religious tradition. the Plymouth colony settled by the Pilgrims, which were escaping religious persecution, the Puritans farther north, trying to purify the religion. But what I want to talk about today, just to kind of give you a heads up, and you have to excuse me as I get a little water. They clobbered me at dialysis.